6.
I believe we have a quorum present, even if they are all in their places, those bright, shiny faces. But we have the first author here, Senator Gerlach, on the subject of retired teachers. Welcome, Senator Gerlach.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This is a very simple and straightforward bill. And oftentimes, I always ask when a bill's before me, what problem are you trying to solve? And the problem here, members, is that there is a problem with getting enough qualified coaches for sports, for high school sports. And I have a person who is an athletic director who's going to tell you a little bit about that, what's going on, and what the proposed solution is. But first, before we do that, members, you have the bill before you, which is a lot of extra language that we really don't need, and I have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, which will make this very simple and straightforward for us. So, members, if we could take that up, maybe if someone could help me get that author's amendment.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. Well, as I said, the problem we're trying to solve here, and this is a very simple and straightforward, we already have in statute, and you know more about the history of this and the necessity dealing with substitute teachers, dealing with early retirement. So teachers retire, but now there is a need for some flexibility. And years ago, again, I don't know the history of the substitute teacher provision, but you've allowed for teachers who have retired early, took early retirement incentives, to be able to be pulled back and used on a limited basis as substitute teachers. Well, the same problem is existing with athletic coaches. And this, the A1 amendment, now the bill before you, simply adds two words, and that is on line 1.8, that this will apply to not only substitute teachers, but or coach. And this will enable us to solve that problem. So with us, I have Mr. Pete Biskins, who is the athletic director at Apple Valley High School, who is dealing with this face-on and has asked for some assistance here. And I'm going to let him tell you about what's going on in his situation.
Thank you very much for having me here today. One of the challenges we face, not only in athletics, but also in the fine arts, is...
Could you give your name and position for the record?
Just for the record.
Yes, my name is Pete Biskins. I'm athletic director and assistant principal at Apple Valley High School. One of the problems that we face right now is retaining and keeping quality coaches in the fine arts and athletics. This provision allows us to continue to have those coaches who still have that passion to work with kids in some way, shape, or form to do that, even if they've taken early retirement. It allows us the opportunity to keep those people on. It doesn't cost the district any more money or anyone any more money. The stipend is the same regardless of if it's a first-year coach or a 40-year coach. And so all it does is gives us the flexibility to keep those people around that are really good with kids. One of the struggles we've had is, as we've had openings, just getting people to even apply for jobs. And it's often a battle. And so if we have people that would continue to work with our kids, even if they've taken early retirement, it sure would be a great help to the school districts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Biskins, can you explain to me why you can't do that now? Because I know, for example, in Hopkins, I can think of an example where a former teacher is one of our football coaches. So what allowed him to be there, and why, in some cases, isn't that, and how does this solve that?
If they have taken the early retirement, incentive, the statute reads that you can no longer work for the district.
Oh.
Some districts are interpreting that in any way, shape, or form. It does say you can continue to substitute teach. I've asked for basically just or coach, and that way they can continue to do that.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Biskin, so probably in the situation that I'm referring to at Hopkins, the person just retired. They didn't take
Correct.
An early retirement package.
Correct.
Gotcha.
It's not me.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to move that Senate File 1062 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
As amended.
As amended.
As amended.
Sorry.
Is there, Senator Hannah's moved?
No.
Senate File 1062 be passed and moved to the floor. Any further discussion? Not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1167 is the department's technical and policy bill, and which we hope to move today in part. I do have an author's amendment that is deleting some of the provisions, and I would like to move the A1 amendment. Has that been distributed? Okay.
Y'all have the A1 amendment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Senator Olson, the A1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion adopted. Senator Olson. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to call on Assistant Commissioner, or is it Deputy? Or Assistant Commissioner Hermanson, who is going to help walk us through the bill, and she will. If you want to track the author's amendment, she will point out what the deleted provisions are as well.
He's going to walk you through.
Okay. She's going to make some general comments, Ms. Hermanson is, and Christine's going to walk us through it.
Ms. Hermanson, if you could identify yourself for the tape.
Certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Liz Hermanson, I'm of the Department of Education. We have our staff here today to help walk through the provisions that we need after we delete all the amendment that was added to the bill, and they will be much more capable of answering the details on those than I am. Christina Gossage will also choreograph and call each person up as we need for those specific amendments. We got this amendment this afternoon. I just wanted to make a couple of very brief general statements. We thank Senator Olson for carrying the bill and the department's technical policy bill. We do have some concerns about the sections that have been deleted. We understand the concerns Senator Olson had about some of these provisions being in the bill, but we do want to be on the record of saying we think some of these sections are important and necessary, and we hope down the road we have an opportunity to have further discussions about the necessity and the importance of maybe that, including them in our final bill somewhere before we adjourn the session. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Christine, and then Tom Melcher and others from our staff will be here to help answer any other detailed questions on the sections that remain.
Madam Chair and members, Christina Gossick, Government Relations. So I'm just going to kind of referee. We have a team of folks here who are going to walk through the various provisions of the bill. And Article 1, we'll start with Dr. Melcher.
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tom Melcher, Department of Education. Article 1, Section 1 is a clarification that interest earned on permanent school fund before they are transferred to the Department of Education remains part of the permanent school fund. It's a clarification of existing practice. I believe it's also included in the Senate budget already. Article 1, Sections 2 and 3 were brought to the department by the non-public school council, and what they do is clarify that textbooks as defined for purposes of non-public pupil aid includes electronic books and other printed materials, as well as books that are on paper. It's an attempt to update the non-public pupil aid law for changes in technology. It doesn't result in any additional aid, but provides more flexibility to non-public school pupils in terms of the choice of instructional materials they can use at money. Section 4 of the bill is relating to the capital project referendum levy, and that is clarifying that the purposes of the capital project referendum levy, that the provisions of Minnesota Statute 123D71 apply, and that is the review and comment statute. There is a $1.4 million limitation on review and comment, so the projects under $1.4 million are not required to have a review and comment. This clarifies that that also applies to the capital project referendum in the same manner. We have had some school districts that have been requesting review and comment on much smaller capital project referendum amounts because of the current wording of the language, and that is unnecessary paperwork on their part. Article 1, Section 5 on page 4 of the bill, page 4 of the bill, and actually the language on page 5 is simply removing an obsolete reference to the old career technical levy statute and replacing it with current reference to the career technical levy statute. Article 1, Section 6 is clarifying the definition of just the general revenue that is used in calculating the special education excess cost aid for charter schools. In the past, the statute only referred to the general education revenue for school districts, and the department has had to make an interpretation of the calculation for charter schools. And this is picking up the definition that we've been operating with in calculating the excess cost aid for charter schools, parallel to what we do with school districts. And there's also some obsolete language related to referendum, which is stricken on page 5 and also the top of page 6. Section 7, dealing with sparsity revenue for closed facilities, is moving back a deadline for a school district that has closed a facility and wants to continue receiving sparsity aid. Currently, the law requires that they notify the department at least 60 days before the end of the school year, which has created some problems, and I think this created some follow-up legislation for the Northland School District this year where they missed a deadline, and this is attempting to try to give school districts that are closing a facility a little bit more time, so we're not requiring them to notify us 60 days before the end of the school year, just simply by the end of the school year. to help prevent that kind of problem from happening in the future. Section 8 of the bill was deleted in the author's amendment. And Section 9 of the bill deals with the levy for retired employee health benefits. And this is clarifying language that reflects the current administrative practice in the department. Page 7, lines 1 and 2 is clarifying that the expenses for which a district levies are the actual amounts that were paid during the previous school year. And on page 7, line 34, there's a clarification that the commissioner may adjust a school district's levy authority as long as the total levy authority does not exceed the maximum. This particular levy, the OPEB levy, has a dollar cap, and sometimes in the past we've had requests for more than the cap, and in that case we prorate. And what we've been doing, if we have a school district ask for a certain amount and then they choose not to levy as they go to their truth and taxation process, we've been adjusting that proration factor so we're staying within the statutory cap. And this clarifies the commissioner's authority to make adjustments to stay within the statutory cap if some districts don't use all of the authority that they have requested. Section 10 of the bill relating to safe schools levy was deleted in the author's amendment. And Section 11 is repealing the obsolete language relating to the career technical levy, the old version of the career technical levy. And that takes care of our discussion.
Madam Chair, Article 2, Section 1 of the bill was also deleted in the author's amendment. And then we're going to have Jennifer Dugan from the testing division present the testing portions of Article 2, beginning with Section 2 on page 10.
Ms. Dugan, could you introduce yourself for the table?
Jennifer Dugan, Minnesota Department of Education.
Ms. Dugan.
Represented during an independent field test and also allowed us to better report out as required against national and international assessments as required by 13.25 and 13.27. Article 2, Section 2, 12.19 to 12.25 clarifies some language to not identify special education students specifically by their assessment past status for graduation. Sections 3 and 4 pertain to test security and not releasing personal demographic information, as well as Section 5.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, what page are you on?
Senator Bonner.
Thank you. For the performance student data is on page 14.
Thank you.
Section 5.
Go ahead, Ms. Keaton.
And then in Section 6 and Section 7 on page 15 is addressing when we adopt a new assessment. There are processes in place that take extra time for that first assessment, and so we would need to delay AYP results that initial year.
All right, Ms. Gossett.
Yep, Madam Chair, I'm going to cover the next couple of sections. Article 2, Section 8, which is on page 15 of the bill, has to do with the highly qualified teacher process under the No Child Left Behind Act. Initially, when NCLB was enacted, states were allowed to use a process called House as an alternative for ensuring that teachers were highly qualified, but this process was basically abolished in 2006, and the language remains in statute. So our teacher licensure division wanted to delete that language from statute so that it was clear to school districts that House was no longer a, permissible method for verifying highly qualified teachers. Article 2, Section 9 of the bill has to do with the staff development report that the Department of Education prepares. We're requesting that that report be submitted to the legislature every 2 years rather than every year. Article 2, Section 10 of the bill has to do with concurrent enrollment aid. This is a request from our career and tech...
Section 9 was deleted.
Oh, it was. Okay. My apologies.
No,
so
right.
Section 9 is not in the bill anymore. Article 2, Section 10 of the bill has to do with the Career and Technical Education Division at the department. We're requesting that career and tech ed courses that are authorized as part of a program of study between MNSCQ and the Commissioner of Education that are rigorous courses that are in partnership with higher ed institutions are permitted to receive concurrent enrollment aid. And then Article 2, Section 11 is the beginning of our charter school portion, and Dave Hartman is going to take over.
Mr. Hartman, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Dave Hartman. I'm the Acting Supervisor of the Charter School Center at the Department.
Thank you. Mr. Hartman.
Section 11, line 18.17, clarifies a note that's present in 1.4.10 regarding the eligibility of authorizers.
And so there was some language change in the author's amendment in that one that I think deletes the $2 million requirement limit and it adds that has been operating continuously for at least 5 years but does not operate a charter school.
Chair. Line 19.27 is a clarification in language. It's misidentified as an affidavit when it's an application for approval that the authorizer goes through.
And Madam Chair, you note on page 19, line 3, we struck no more than three consistent with what's in our other bill relative to the charter schools.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Mr. Hartman.
Thank you,
sorry for interrupting you.
No, actually, I think you have the next
one. So where are we? On page 20.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, page 20, line 23, reinstate the stricken language and delete the new language and strike 2011 and insert 2012. That's the extension of the year.
Thank you. And members, this was all part of the delete all amendment.
That's all part of the delete all amendment. That provision has been dealt with elsewhere.
Didn't delete everything.
Sandra Olson.
And let's see. If I'm 2026. Oh, this one is it's deleting that reinstating the stricken language and deleting the new language on lines 26, 27 through 32, and 21 line 14 is reinstate the stricken language, and then on 2116, deleting the new language.
Mr. Hartman?
Madam Chair, line 23.7 through 23.17 clarifies the eligible individuals or individuals who are eligible to serve on charter school boards. It identifies that teachers are the sole employees who may serve on a board. State law requires that at least one teacher currently serve on the charter school board. It allows for more than, but it limits it only to teachers who are employed at the school. Further, it excludes contractors from board membership, and it restricts the CFO and the chief administrator to non-voting members of charter school boards.
And then page 24, the section 13 is deleted in the author's amendment.
Madam Chair, line 26.6 through 26.8 identifies that a financial service provider to a charter school must agree to make available information about the charter school's financial audit to the commissioner upon request. Schools are required to provide that information. We regard that as public information, and so the provider would be required to disclose that information to the commissioner.
And Madam Chair, section 15 is deleted. 16? Be a tag team here.
Mr. Hartman?
16 is still in. Page 27.
I believe we're on page
20. Is that 16? Is that,
okay. Dr. Melcher?
And then Mr. Melcher.
Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Article 2, section 16 deals with the payment of aids to charter schools, and this specifies that a charter school must have a valid signed contract on file at the department at least 15 days before we start paying them. We make payments twice a month, and this just gives the department 2 weeks to make payments. There were some issues that came up last year where we weren't sure if some charter schools were going to have their contracts renewed, and we didn't want to be in a position of having paid them and then find out that it never got approved, and it's very difficult to get money back if the charter school didn't have any money coming for the year. So this is just protecting the state from not overpaying somebody until they have a contract in place and giving us 2 weeks to get the payments processed, and then also specifies that if a charter school is only has a contract for part of the year, that they only get paid for part of the year. So it's kind of just a kind of a common sense thing that protects the state from not overpaying somebody and then not being able to get the money back.
And Madam Chair, the next section, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, are all deleted as part of the Oscar's Amendment.
Madam Chair, that brings us to Article 3, the special education article. So starting with Section 1 on page 31, this section updates some of the terminology used in our special education statutes so that it's consistent with the special education rule and with IDEA. And Dr. Melcher is going to cover Section 2, which is replaced with language that was in the author's amendment on care and treatment.
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Turn to the amendments at the bottom of page 1 and also on page 3. There is language that is clarifying the responsibility of the department to resolve disputes between school districts regarding the residency. The language on page 1 relates to residency for special education students. The language on page 3 relates to non-special education students who are served in care and treatment, and it's reflecting the current situation that we have. It's pretty rare. 3 or 4 times a year there's a situation where both school districts claim that that's not their student, and they don't want to pay the bill, and this is clarifying that the department has the responsibility to make a ruling in that situation that quite often occurs with parents that are going through a separation process, and the kid lives, you know, some of the days of the week with one parent, some of the days with the other parent, so there's some dispute. They might be living in different school districts, and they're not always communicative. This is allowing the department in those kinds of rare situations to make a ruling on which school district has to pay the bill.
Madam Chair, Article 3, Section 3 is a repealer. It repeals an interagency office on transition services. This is an office that no longer exists within the department, and the functions are covered by our Special Education Policy Division. And then Article 4, which is our facilities article, will be Dr. Melcher again.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Article 4 is a fairly lengthy article dealing with clarification of the health and safety language. And I believe you have similar language in the budget bill. This has been discussed earlier in the Senate. And what this does, I won't go through all of the details, but it is reviewing the language in the health and safety statute, kind of streamlining it, simplifying it, trying to reduce some paperwork for school districts in their application for health and safety without adding any new fiscal impact. So we had kind of a fine line. Last year we did quite a bit of work with some of the suburban metropolitan facilities directors and research staff and the other body, and there was a bill that was created and heard last year, and then again Senator Limmer had a similar language this year, which the goal is to cut down on the paperwork burden for both the school districts and the Department of Education without increasing the cost of the health and safety levy.
And Madam Chair, we actually have an amendment that makes a few technical corrections to that section of the bill.
Senator,
I'd like to move the A2 amendment. I would like to move the A2 amendment. Does, as you said.
A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Amendments adopted.
Madam Chair and members, if I could move on to Article 5 of the bill, which deals with accounting, page 40, and after the language is on page 41, is restoring language that was inadvertently deleted, I think, in 2001, that relates to the penalty, the aid penalty, if a school district has violated state law or rule. During the Ventura administration, the department made some recommendations for changing the process, streamlining this law, and inadvertently there was some language that was deleted, which directs us which violations of law fall under 127A42 process and which fall under the 127A43 process. And this is restoring language that was inadvertently deleted, which specified that in the case of a teacher licensing violation, that the penalty is calculated under 127A43, which calls for a 60% reduction of general education aid attributable to the non-licensed teacher, where under 127A42, there is a more flexibility. We call for up to 60% of the aid to be reduced and have a more lengthy process. So this is restoring the law to where it was before some other changes that occurred that inadvertently deleted this. This just came up this last year as we had the Attorney General review which law would apply in one of the charter school adjustments that we had because of non-licensed teachers, and we just wanted to bring this back to provide further clarification as to which law is applied in terms of the penalty calculations. Section 2 of the bill deals with, it is the 127A43 language, and the past practice in this case is we have used the term withheld to actually mean reduced. But it's not very clear because the law in 127A42 was subsequently amended to say withheld or reduced. And this is clarifying that if you have non-licensed teachers, what we really mean is your aid is reduced. It's not just temporarily withheld and then paid back. So that reflects past practice, and it does have a penalty with teeth in it if school districts hire non-licensed teachers. So that's been current practice. This is amending the law to reflect that practice. Article 5, Section 3 deals with the payment of state aids, and it specifies that state aids are only paid to school districts, charter schools, or other education organizations earning the state aid as a result of providing education services. We have had some persistent inquiries from creditors, normally banks that have loans to charter schools, asking us to pay them directly. And we don't think it's appropriate for the Department of Education to make decisions as to whether we ought to pay the school district or the bank. That's something that the bank should be suing the school district or the charter school if they don't think they're getting a proper payment on their outstanding debts. And so this is clarifying state law to say that the State Department of Education only pays the school district or the charter school or the cooperative that earned the money, and that anything that happens to the money after that is between the school district and their creditors.
Senator Cathedrals.
And then Article 6?
Madam Chair, Article 6 is deleted in the author's amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't notice it. I didn't turn the page here. So that brings us to the end of the, yes.
Article 7.
To Article 7.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, Tom Melcher, Article 7 deals with student transportation. And this is an effort to simplify the cost allocation procedure, where we have school districts reporting costs in multiple categories of transportation. We have regular transportation, we have special education transportation, we have field trips and so forth. And currently we have multiple options for the way school districts might allocate costs. This would create one more uniform, consistent method of allocating costs on a cost per mile basis and deletes the options to allocate based on a cost per hour or a cost per route, which are very, very little used currently. It also adds new language on page 44, lines 21 to 31, which provides that in certain fairly narrow circumstances, a school district's actual bid prices for contracted transportation can be used in lieu of the standard allocation method. And that only occurs if the school district is bidding its contract separately for different categories of transportation, and they get multiple bids from their bidders, so that we know that there isn't any untoward behavior going on where they're allocating more money into a particular category that has a higher reimbursement rate, that this is based on a multiple bid situation. So we think that provides a little more flexibility for the school districts in that circumstance. That's the end of the call.
Members, are there any questions? I have one question for Mr. Hartman. I know we dealt with charter schools here in the bill. This isn't exactly in this piece of this proposal before us, but I'm thinking maybe you might be able to talk to us a little bit about what do we have for an appeal process. So we're in this season now when authorizers are making decisions that they might not authorize some charter schools. And that leaves communities and families and students in a real lurch. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe describe for us what that appeal process is like for a charter school whose authorizer has decided not to reauthorize. Mr. Hartman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's in state law right now identifies Subdivision 23 of the Charter School Law. Paragraphs A and B identify the process through which an authorizer for cause termination or non-renewal of a charter school contract. And the process that's identified is that once the there are three aspects of law that allow an authorizer to terminate or non-renew the contract for cause. Once they file that notice, the charter school has 15 business days with which to request an informal hearing with the authorizer, in front of the authorizer. And then once that informal hearing occurs, then the authorizer makes a determination as to whether or not to follow through with the initial notice that they filed with the school to terminate the contract or not renew the contract. Now, what precedes that are some of the newer aspects of the 2009 legislation, which my office oversees, and that has to do with the authorizer approval process. So some of those processes require that authorizers have intervention policies and processes that they identify, have reviewed by the department and by the internal and external reviewers in order to earn approval to be an approved authorizer. So what would precede a non-renewal or a for cause or a termination for cause would be interventions that would precede that particular notice. And through that process, you know, it varies from one authorizer to the next. However, we encourage authorizers to identify their clear expectations and the timelines for those to resolve the issues that they identify. Now, what's encouraged or expected through that process is that the authorizer makes clear their expectations, and the school has opportunities to respond to those over time, so that when they get to the aspect of a non-renewal for cause or a termination for cause, that it's not a surprise. The caveat to that is only in an extremely egregious situation, where I think everybody in this room would agree that an authorizer ought to intervene and give a termination notice for egregious acts. Every other, I guess, opportunity or situation would be preceded with some notices that came in front of the non-renewal or the termination notice.
Thank you. Can you, what I'm wondering about is, it sounds like there's interventions, but they are not exactly standardized as far as timing. So is it conceivable that we could have a charter school who receives some intervention requirements or suggestions, and yet the authorizer would proceed with a non-renewal, but yet the there hasn't been time for either the interventions to work or for accountability to see if those interventions work? And then I guess if that's the case, where's the appeal process? I understand what you're saying here, but I don't hear anything about an appeal process, and it sounds rather un-American not to have an appeal process.
Madam Chair, I don't know if it's my place to comment on whether it's un-American or not.
Those are my words. However,
state law does not identify an appeal process. In paragraph C of subdivision 23, a mutual non-renewal or mutual termination is an option for an authorizer to put forth for a charter school. In that case, both parties would have to, and then the recourse is that the charter school has the opportunity to make a change of authorizer or make a change of authorizer request with an approved authorizer to the commissioner. It's not the appeal process that I think you envisioned in that question. It is an alternative route. But the changes, as we understand them in the 2009 changes to the charter school law, put the responsibility firmly on the shoulders of the authorizer to hold schools accountable to the performance that's identified within their contract. Now, where it's not an appeal process, but where then the recourse is that we in my office and we as the greater agency have a responsibility to hold an authorizer accountable to fulfilling all of those expectations in their approved authorizer application. So if they're acting without due process or allowing for resolution that is reasonable or inconsistent with their approved application, well, then it's our issue. If it's pointed out to us and through our regular oversight, we notice that they're not giving enough opportunity to the schools that they oversee.
So it would be up to the charter school then to notify your office that they felt the authorizer either didn't do the interventions or there wasn't time for the interventions to take place or time to measure the interventions. And is that a form or just a call to you, or how do they do that?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Hartman.
The charter school has that opportunity to contact us. We have no formal process identified there, but it's not limited to the charter school itself. If complaints come into the department, we regard them and we distribute them to the division that has the responsibility of following through when appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Hartman. I appreciate that.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Torsby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson, I have a question about a delete that I'm curious about. It's on page 31, and it's in your author's amendment to delete a section 20 about English language proficiency standards. I didn't know that this was going to be part of this bill, but I was quite happy to see it at the last minute, in part because I don't know if you remember our conversations about really entering a process to create some standards for the state and understanding that we have a significant growth of ELL population and the state not having, some districts not having the resources to adopt standards, not others having more access to technical support. And this language seems to be kind of the intent here seems to be heading in the direction of adopting some standards. I don't know if there was a reason for why you thought this should not be there, and I don't know if the department can elaborate on the value of having this. I don't know the history, so I'm not quite prepared to talk more about it, but I wanted to hear your thoughts.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray. I think this is a subject that will have some further discussion. Ms. Montano would be the one to be here for that discussion, and she is, I think, heading to the airport. So we left it in the amendment to remove it, but it may well come. I suspect that that's a subject that the department would like to revisit further.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Bonham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have questions on page 10 and then 15 and 16, but I wondered if even perhaps before I do my questions, if Senator Olson would like to make any comments, because I understood at the beginning that there were some things that you weren't certain of in the technical bill. Is anything you want to share with the committee, or are you comfortable with all the things in the technical bill?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, as I think for a variety of reasons, we have removed some provisions for consistency with other actions and some of other policy discussions that I think will continue. And so we've taken those from this bill, and I'm satisfied with the with the bill as it stands to go forward.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, then just a few questions. On page 10, where it talks about the commissioner identifies for standalone field testing or other national sampling must participate as directed. Could you somebody tell me about that practice? I'm not familiar with that, and when nationally we require schools to participate for sampling purposes.
Madam Chair, I think Jennifer Dugan from the Assessment Division might want to address that question.
And that is one that we deleted. I believe.
Ms. Dugan?
Did we?
Page 10.
Oh. Yeah, they did.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I didn't catch that. So we deleted this part? Mm-hmm. Good. Okay, thank you. I feel better about that. Then now going to page, and so I could find that with all of my things, but going to page 15, we went from being very clear about when we were going to publish the adequate yearly progress and other data to the commissioner publicly releases the data. Did we change that? It's on line 15.16. I'm concerned that that doesn't give any kind of structure to when we must release our public data.
They release the no later than September 1st, except when. So there's still a concrete time frame for releasing the data, except when it's that first administration to allow us to do the technical work to ensure that we have released valid and reliable results.
Madam Chair, that isn't how I read this. It looked to me like there were two pieces to this. First, with regard to our own testing, saying that until we did say not later than 10 days after the appeal procedure, and now we're saying until the commissioner. And then later we talk about the commissioner shall annually post federal adequate yearly progress data. And so I had understood that those things to be referring to different data. Are we referring to the same data? Because I know we have certain state standards, state tests, and then there are certain things that are required by federal law.
Senator Bonham, I've been advised it is the same data.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
And Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, I'm not sure when the federal government is going to act, but this provision may be moot.
Okay.
Before too long anyway.
Okay, good. Thank you. And then lastly, Madam Chair, thank you. With regard to the change in the reference to the House, H-O-U-S-S-E, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we still used that reference in our new alternative licensure language, and so I'm just wondering about that inconsistency. And then we refer in this section to the approved Minnesota highly qualified plan. I know that we're underway with regard to creating that, but we don't have one yet. So I'm wondering how, both about the inconsistency in the law we just passed and then what we're actually referring to in this section.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoeff, if this becomes law, it will be have passed after the other one, and therefore I think that that consistency would be corrected.
Okay.
If it was dealing with the same section of law, we'll have to take a look at it. But maybe staff could determine if that was if that's a provision, the inconsistency that you see, that if in fact it's changed, and if a bill that's passed later, if that would in fact affect the same change in the alternative pathways.
And, Madam Chair, follow up on that point, and then what is the approved Minnesota highly qualified plan that we now refer to?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoeff, I'm definitely not the expert in this, and we can talk to our educator licensing division and get back to you with answers. I believe we're operating under an approved highly qualified plan now, and my understanding is this is a plan that we submit to the federal government to ensure that we're complying with this section of ESEA. But, I can get you a copy of the plan if that's helpful.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd appreciate it. And then lastly, on a completely different subject,
before you leave that
okay.
topic, Ms. Younger has a comment.
Yep, Madam Chair, members, the language in the bill actually reflects the amendments that were in the Alternative Pathways Bill, so there wouldn't be a conflict between what's happening in Article 2, Section 8 on page 15 and what happened in the Alternative Teacher Licensure Bill.
Right. Thank you.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you. And then lastly, with regard to unlicensed teachers in the classroom, there has been several articles in the newspaper in recent weeks about unlicensed teachers being in the classroom, and it talked about that we as a department or as a state have not always done anything with regard to those infractions, and now I'm seeing that there is actually a law that exists with teeth, and so I'm wondering, Dr. Melcher, if you could address whether or not we've been implementing that law and what the status of that is.
Dr.
Melcher. Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoeff, I would need to touch base with Rose Hermanson if she's still around or with our teacher licensing people. I've been involved in calculating age penalties for two or three charter schools. That's the only experience that I have with that statute over 30 years. And those were occurring in the last two or three years.
Madam Chair and other committee members, I don't know if anyone else were reading these articles, but they talked about the many infractions that were happening in the Minneapolis School District and what Superintendent Bernadia Johnson was doing as a result of it. And it seemed in the case that was reported in the newspaper that it was punitive to the students. And so I was left confused about that. And so does this section of law apply to our regular public schools as well?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonas, it does apply to regular school districts as well. I think it has been very, very rarely used. And I think there was some recent discussion coming from conversations the commissioner had that the department was going to begin looking at this much more closely. But I think we should probably get back to you with more information, unless you've got some information.
Madam Chair, I would only reiterate what Dr. Melcher said, that based on the commissioner's comments in the newspaper, that she was really concerned about the information that came forward in the Star Tribune report. But whether or not, I mean, the exact response that we're going to take, I'm not sure that I can speak to that right now.
Thank you.
Any other comments? Senator
Dino. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a real quick question. I'll address this to you, Senator Olson, but anyone can answer. On pages 2 and 3, there's some inserted language on lines 2.9, 2.14, and 3.2. My question has to do with We're specifically listing e-books and other electronic versions. My question is, as it's read, I could read that, it says, as well as other printed materials delivered electronically. I could read that two ways, and I'm just trying to get to intent. An e-book might or might not have ever been printed in tangible hard copy, as well as much other electronic material. Is the intent here to say, if it's printed material, but we're getting an electronic version, that's okay. But if it was never printed, that's not okay. Or is that just a nuance of the language, and your intent is to get at basically anything, even if it never was printed in a tangible hard copy?
Madam Chair and Senator Nienau, I think the intent was simply to update the law to reflect the electronic versions of textbooks or book substitutes that are used as a text. So it's not any book or electronic book. It's a book that's used as a textbook or a text substitute in a particular class. Sometimes you'll be in a literature class and the textbook substitute might be reading, you know, five novels if the teacher assigns. And I think typically these would be books that have been published on paper first that they now have an electronic version of, but it could conceivably be something that was only published electronically, but it would have to be something that was a textbook.
Okay. Thank you, Madam. I just asked that question to get to intent because there's a lot of money involved in textbook publishing, and if there's a lawsuit, now we have it on record.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator
Blair. The other Ted. I'd like to go back to the licensure violations topic. For you, Senator Olson, you've got a lot of years of experience. What is your reaction to that, and what are our response as a Senate, as a education committee body here, to what we've recently read?
Well, Senator Daley, one thing I have learned, and I will say this a bit gingerly, maybe I was taught that at home, that be careful not to read everything or believe everything you read in the paper. There's sometimes the story is a little bit different, and I know it was a wake-up call to a lot of people. I think I talked with one of the superintendents in Senator Wieger's district and said, what's going on here? And just in passing to that, they've got it straightened out. You know, I mean, whether there was just some sloppy vigilance or who knows what was happening there. We did have some time with the Board of Teaching and understand that the Board of Teaching sets the standards and gives the approvals. It is the department that issues the license. So it isn't necessarily the Board of Teaching's responsibility to do that enforcement. It may well be with the department, and I think that's what you're taking a look at. What are the procedures? I'm sure that every school district submits their teaching cohort someplace, probably electronically, and that ought not to be too hard with our efforts and data quality to be able to cross-link and some of these lists and get those answers. Having said that, I think that this teacher licensure is something that needs some further attention by this committee and as we go forward, because there is some concern that particularly those that are in rural districts or districts that have a challenge of the over-specialization of licensure. I know there was some people coming in concerned that there's another category for special ed that, you know, wanting to be added. You know, it may become impossible to find people to cover the needs in these various schools. So somehow I think we need to start having a look at how we categorize and how we structure that licensure. I haven't got any preconceived notions as to what that exactly is, but I hear that surfacing of what we might do that will, you know, not want to sacrifice on quality, but with a lot of the things that are resources that are available to help in certain areas, that we may want to look at a different approach to what effective teachers are, what it takes to get them there, and what we use as a basis for licensure.
Follow up. Senator Olson, just because I'm not familiar with it, I feel I need to ask the question. Showing concern is one thing. Following up and seeing what those results are is another thing. I guess I'd like to know what the process is for the department to provide us a report with what happened, with their follow-up. I want to see that. I want to know what happened, what they did, what the results were. Is there a process that we have that we go through to follow up on those kinds of things, or is that micromanaging?
Dr. Milton.
Madam Chair and Senator Daley, the department would be happy to review this, and I can bring it back to the commissioner and produce information for the committee. I'd be happy to do that.
And I would say I too have been a little concerned when I've read the situation in Broadway High School, and that somehow the students aren't being allowed to graduate because they discovered that a couple teachers did not have licenses. How did they perform? Did they complete and meet the standards? Why would they not be allowed to graduate? I mean, it's why take it out on the kids? There may be some lessons there. I'm not sure what the background of these teachers was, but I think it would be helpful to know a little bit more about that kind of situation and that consequence. I have some agreement with Senator Bonoff.
Thank you.
Most importantly, what are we going to do to be proactive to take measures to make sure this doesn't continue to happen?
Well, Senator Daley, you're a member of this body, too. If you've got some suggestions and ideas, we're all ears. All of us love to hear new ideas, don't we?
Yes.
Members, we have two more bills up. Are there any other questions on this bill? Senator Clark.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Olson, I have a question also because of an article in the newspaper, which I don't always believe what I read in the newspaper. but being a group from Blue Sky Charter School testified in front of this committee. I'm led to believe from a newspaper article that the Department of Education is looking to essentially close that school down. Is there any language in this that addresses some of the rights that a charter school might have if they are found to be in violation, if they clean up what they did, if they correct the problems that they had? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Madam Chair and Senator DeCraif, we did remove some provisions that really, some of them probably went closer to shoring up the action taken in that kind of a situation. And I think that needs to be looked at more closely, and I think you make a very good point in terms of what that process. We did spend a lot of time establishing the authorizers and the process for doing that, and then that the authorizers, you would think, would have some responsibility for making some of those kinds of decisions, and if not, that's the department oversees the authorizers. But you know, I don't know that we have time for that whole debate. I don't know that the final decision has been made. I believe that the commissioner has been kind of separated from all of this goings on because she has to make the final decision. And I think maybe is in the process of reviewing those things and making that final decision. But that's so that is not a closed issue yet.
Okay.
Mr. Hartman, did you have something?
Correct me, because I can be wrong.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator. The specificity in terms of public policy lies in Subdivision 23, Paragraph D, which allows for a public hearing if the commissioner moves to terminate or not, to terminate a charter school contract between the charter school and the authorizer. That public hearing has not occurred yet, and as Senator Olson identifies, the process is not yet concluded. We're in the midst of that right now.
Question from that?
Well, yeah. I mean, in the bill here, it looks like the decision of the commissioner is final. And I guess I have a question, to make sure that people have their due process. And basically, when Blue Sky came, I had a conversation with the interim superintendent who basically felt the Department of Education is somewhat dysfunctional. And they gave an awful lot of information to your office and to justify that things had been corrected, and got very little or no feedback at all. And that's, I guess, why I really do have a concern, that I want to know that people have due process before actions are taken.
No, but I would move that if there's no further discussion, that Senate File 1167 be, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no.
Thank you. Thank you, members. Thank you so much, staff. Thank you, Senator Olson. Nice to be at this end of the table now. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1213. I'd like to move that Senate File 1213 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. And before we do that, Madam Chair, I have an author's amendment. Okay. Then we'll move on. I do have an author's amendment, Madam Chair. And I'd like to move the I don't have that amendment in front of me. Should be the okay. All right. I think that might be for my bill tonight, so we'll hold off on that bill. This bill's in good shape, Madam Chair.
The staff is in shock, and we'll give them a few minutes to regain composure because they usually don't slip up on things like this. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I was just getting to make sure you were all on your toes. And I'd also like to thank Senator Wolf and Senator Bonoff for co-authoring this with me. Senate File 1213 is a proposal to make changes to the Adult Basic Education Performance Tracking System. This will improve ABE's capacity to comply with required federal reporting, and it will improve programming, and it will enhance the ability to conduct longitudinal studies. The tracking system was put into place in 2000 to comply with federal law. It also serves as a mechanism to assess the effectiveness of ABE programs. The bill makes several modifications to improve our ability at both state and local levels to evaluate the effectiveness of adult basic education programming and obtain information regarding the effectiveness of ABE's collaboration with partner agencies in human services, higher education, and workforce development. Today, I have three testifiers to discuss adult basic education and the proposal before us. I have Julie Niggin. She's the director of adult basic education in the Rochester School District. On my right is Heather Tomlinson. She's a former Rochester adult basic education student. And on the end is Tom Citron-Heisem, who's here on behalf of the Literacy Action Network to describe the changes proposed. And Madam Chair, if I might turn it over to Ms. Niggin.
want to state your name and position for the record.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chairman. Senators, I'm Julie Niggin. I'm manager of the Delta Family Literacy Programming for the Rochester Public Schools and the administrator of Hawthorne Education Center. In that role, I'm really happy to collaborate with other state and local agencies to provide quantitative outcomes for adult basic education services. So what are those services? What services does ABE or Adult Basic Ed provide? We provide English language instruction. We provide basic skills instruction, GED preparation testing, diploma completion, family literacy, computer literacy, citizenship preparation, college readiness, and career preparation for adults. And adults are considered anyone over the age of 16, no longer registered in a public school. These programs, these ABE, Adult Basic Ed programs, have long-term outcomes that include, they're quantifiable, and they include post-secondary entrance, employment, and financial independence for our adult learners. These are positive, long-term accomplishments and outcomes for the learners, for their families, and for the people of the state of Minnesota. In my job as a manager of ABE and Administrator Hawthorne, I get to see things you don't. I get to see those moments. I get to hear from teachers. I get to meet students, men in their 50s, who come to me and show me the first chapter book they've ever read in their lives, or women who are displaced homemakers who have never touched a computer and have not only gained the literacy and computational skills that they need, the English language skills that they need, but also the computer skills they need to go to the computer in school, to write a resume, to prepare it, to go online looking for employment, to fill out an application online, and to become employed. I get to see that all the time, and you don't. That's why the learners at Hawthorne and the ABE learners throughout the state of Minnesota, their teachers and the volunteers who serve them, get out of bed every morning and come to school. Qualitative and anecdotal evidence is heartwarming, it is compelling, but it cannot be the only thing that you receive that lets you, as senators, as legislators, decide where funding should go, what programs are effective. I can tell you a million stories, but I know often you want to see numbers. This bill does speak to those numbers. We all in ABE recognize the need for quantitative evidence of our effectiveness. With me, I've brought Heather. And the nice part about bringing Heather with me is that she exemplifies a collaboration between Olmsted County Social Services and Hawthorne Education Center, the ABE program. She also exemplifies the hard work done by learners and staff and volunteers at Hawthorne, and she shows us both the qualitative and quantitative outcomes of adult basic education services.
Madam Chair, might I turn it over to Heather?
Hi, I'm Heather Tomlinson. I'm a former student of Hawthorne Educational Center. I just want to thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members for letting me come here and share my story. I want you to hear how valuable it has been in my life, how it's completely changed my life. I started there. I was on public assistance. I was then given the opportunity to participate in the internship program through the Olmsted County, where I then proceeded to get my education and training at Hawthorne, which led to not only full-time employment, but also purchasing my first home. So it made a huge, huge impact on my life. Thank you.
And if we might turn it over to Mr. Heisem.
My name is Tom Citrin Heisem, and I represent...
A little closer.
I'm sorry. My name is Tom Citrin Heisem, and I represent the Literacy Action Network, a statewide advocacy group for adult basic education. And we have approximately 400 members around the state in all 51 ABE consortia that deliver services around the state. And it's always challenging following a learner because they tell their story so dramatically, and all I can do is sort of recite the dry statistics and so on. But I just wanted very briefly to talk about the specifics of Senate File 1213, which, as the Senator noted, makes slight modifications to the adult education performance tracking system. The tracking system has been in place for about 10 years and was put in place to meet the federal reporting requirements through data matching rather than through follow-up surveys. We can do either one of those things. Data matching is by far the most efficient and time-effective way of doing this. It's more accurate because we can track data between systems. It's very often hard through surveys to find our students years later and figure out what they've done in their lives. I've talked to the Department of Education ABE staff, and they've told me there is no cost to this, and in fact, this probably will free up some funds for direct instruction because the cost of doing data matching are actually less than the follow-up survey. So there are essentially four changes. The first one just puts some clarifying language in. It says for required reporting, longitudinal studies, and program improvement. So this just clarifies the purpose of the tracking system so it's more clear to everybody. Number two says reduction in diversionary work program, MFEP, food support, education, and training program. And this is a follow-up goal that is part of the federally mandated national reporting system but was not in the original legislation for whatever reason. So we're just trying to bring it into compliance with federal requirements. The third change puts in the Office of Higher Education, which will help us allow for identification of students who enroll in private post-secondary education schools through matching the data collected by the Office of Higher Education and help find where our students go and what they accomplish by following them through time. And the fourth and final change inserts the Department of Human Services, and this is needed to determine the reduction in receipt of public assistance, which we hope is sometimes tied to our work, through data matching with the MFEPs and SNAP data sets at DHS. I just want to close with making two quick comments that participation in this system on the part of students is completely voluntary. If we ask for students' information, we do not turn them away if they choose not to give that for whatever personal reasons. And we also give all students the Tennyson warning that they sign, acknowledging that they understand they're giving the data they give us voluntarily and what purposes it can be used for. So I just wanted to make those points. So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Madam Chair, and just a couple of quick comments. All of us in this room realize how important education is for a person's livelihood, and this is a way that we are able to provide education services so that men and women can get the training that they need so they can continue on to live independent lives. And again, that's what we're doing in adult basic education. And really, the meat of the bill is in line 1.20 and 1.21. We know that we're increasingly data-driven, and we need data. We need accountability to show exactly what the outcomes are. We're very outcome-oriented in education. And so by collecting this data, we will have hard and fast numbers to show adult basic education's impact in reducing MFIP and reducing a diversionary work programs. So it's something that can be incorporated into what's already being done. I think it will provide great data for us in the future.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Nelson. Maybe you may know this, or if not, someone else might. But this performance tracking has been in place for 10 years, and the current language and the current law requires certain things to be reported. I don't recall ever seeing a report, and it does say on the back, it says that the department may release the summary data. But can anyone tell us what the results have been from that we've been tracking for the last 10 years, and does anybody know?
I can, Madam Chair, I can't recite all of the results. I do know that each year the report is actually, Senator, is submitted to the department, to the federal authorities. And as far as I know, that's public data. I don't know for sure whether it's ever been released in kind of a broad way. We certainly in the field receive a summary each year of how we've done on each of the NRS goals. So it's certainly public information, and I think the department would be happy to send it to you.
I just, Madam Chair, just curious. We've had a reporting of performance for 10 years on certain things, and I understand you're increasing the things, but it might be good to see what we've been doing so far, and who knows, maybe it would be helpful to see that report. I don't know how to get it. I didn't realize we even had it. So,
Madam Chair, I have looked at the reports, although I can't recite them all for the last 10 years, but I do know that there has been steady improvement each and every year. statewide. What are called the NRS goals are negotiated between the adult basic education staff at ABE, at MDE, and the federal authorities each year. And then at the end of each program year, the statistics for each consortium in the state and for the state cumulatively are put together and reported to the feds. And I know there are charts that have shown the accomplishments year by year by year. So I don't have those right now, but I'm sure the department would be able to forward those to you.
So, Mr. Shackleton, I see you hiding behind a pillar over there, but they did. No, I'm kidding you. Do you know if these reports are online or how available they might be, or are you making some notes to?
Sorry, Mr. Shackleton,
Senator Hanna has asked about whether the performance tracking system, the reports that have come out with the statute as it is now, he had never seen anything showing that tracking. And apparently within the ABE community, that information is accessible and shared. But how accessible? Is it online, or how would one obtain a report of how ABE has been performing by the current criteria?
I agree with the superintendent.
Okay.
You can go online to the State Department of Ed and go to the ABE link, and you will get a link about the report card of each district, each consortium in the ABE network in Minnesota. Each district received a report card. Each district reported all of this, and it's all on there. Now, this is the self-reported stuff, data. There's also data that is linked by their students' social security numbers. I don't personally have access to that. That would have to be something that I'm not quite sure who does it, but Gary Schaefer will probably know. But if you want to know the self-reported information in all these areas, you will find it on the Minnesota Department of Ed website.
Senator Olson? Thank you. Senator. It might be interesting in knowing that this data is not just stacked and put on a shelf somewhere. As Julie mentioned, we each get a report for our consortium, and we get a wrap-up report for the entire state. Minnesota for as many years as I can remember, has been above the national average in our attainment of all of the goals. And, in fact, the attainment of these goals has helped us get a number of what are called WIA incentive grants that have helped fund a number of collaborative programs statewide. The Department of Ed also takes the certain consortia who, for whatever reason, are lower than they should be, although the whole state as an average is higher, and uses this data to work with them on a very intensive improvement process. So although the data may not have been sent to the committee, I do want to reassure you that it is very actively used in the field and widely understood. And there's been a really significant emphasis in the last 5 or 6 years on using this data to improve services.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Scott.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this is for Mr. Shackleton again. But is the department presumably aware that reference is made to longitudinal data study in here, and Ms. Wagner is, I think, the project manager on that, and this may also be another type of data that's being collected, and I'm wondering if there's going to be some integration of this type of data.
She's definitely seen language.
A little louder, please.
Sorry.
Is that
I don't think this is actually turned out because I couldn't hear her.
Okay.
She is aware of of this language she has with it. I'm not sure to what extent it's working. You guys can communicate.
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, everybody's on board with the language. So,
okay. So, Madam Chair, for the longitudinal data study information where there's an identifier number on every student, that'll continue for everyone that's in ABE. Would there be a separate type of longitudinal data for tracking their progress? They could have been in the public school system at one point. Will these intersect, or will these be two different systems of data?
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Wigger, I don't know what the current process is for that.
I can tell you that the intent of this legislation is to add two additional pieces of information to what is currently done, which I think Senator Hand's committee would find of great interest, which is how does ABE affect MFIP and the diversionary work programs. But certainly I'm sure we could get someone from the department to talk to you about how those longitudinal studies are recorded and if they're merged. My experience from the school district is there's one number, I think it's called a SARS number, for a student.
MARS.
A MARS number, thank you. So the MARS number is the same for whatever things the student happens to be involved in.
Thank you.
Yes, Ms. The MARS number is K-12. And while a student is in K-12, that is the number they're identified by. It is not their Social Security number. When you enter an ABE program, one of the identifiers, and the identifier that the state uses to track this, is the Social Security number. Now, will a student have a MARS number and a Social Security number? Of course they will. Because, yes, you're right, our students were in K-12 probably much longer than they're with us. They might be with us 2 years. They were in K-12 a lot longer than that. We're going to be tracking them from when they entered and then exited ABE using the Social Security. They will not be using the MARS number.
There's no further discussion. Senator Nelson, moved Senate File 1213 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, just curious, Senator Nelson, did Senator Limmer indicate jurisdiction interest on the Social Security number and Office of Higher Ed and et cetera? Probably a courtesy call. I'm sure he's very busy, but usually it makes it stop there. We're adding Office of Higher Ed.
The use of the Social Security number has not changed. But we can certainly talk to Senator Limmer. But there's nothing, the only thing the bill changes is participation in MFIP and DWP.
Madam Chair, what I see is the sharing of the Social Security number in addition to what is stated at line 2.17 through 19 would go to the Office of Higher Ed and to Human Services. So that was what I was focused on. If I'm fine with that, but it might be something Senator Limmer would catch later.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. I think that's a good point. He's usually right on top of those things, but I will definitely bring this to his attention. Thank you.
There's no further discussion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. The amendment is available. The bill is passed and will be sent to the floor. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll sit here at the working microphone. We had a problem with that microphone in the other committee today. I don't know, maybe it's not connected today. Thank you, and Madam Chair and members. Senate File 619, and those of you who have been in this committee for the past 2 or 3 years may recognize this bill. This is a bill that I introduced a few years ago, and as part of the discussion we were having at that time, and I thought it might be pertinent to reintroduce it given some of the conversations we've been having this year about things like local control, things like reform, how do we do things in a way that might be more conducive to, changing the structure of the public education process. And I would, as I was thinking about this, I thought had we passed this 2 or 3 years ago, whenever we had done that, it might have obviated the necessity to pass a 2-year wage and salary freeze that we have inserted in our omnibus bill. Because what this bill does is it allows that school boards, by vote of the board, can designate funds at their discretion, either by a specific dollar amount or by a percentage, whichever way they wish. They may designate certain dollars to be used for specific purposes that are called essential uses. They may reserve monies for essential uses. And what this does is it, in effect, allows a local school board to create their own mandates. We've talked about the problem that mandating activities at the local level bring to local school districts. And there are a couple of mandates in this bill that are repealed. There's three, actually. There's a repeal of the 2% staff development set aside and all the attendant provisions on how those monies must be used. There's also a reserve that we've established at the state level to deal with class size reduction, and a third mandate that deals with gifted and talented programs. All those are repealed or set aside if a local district chooses to reserve funds for those purposes at the district level. So in addition to those things, if a district decides to reserve monies for those purposes, it is relieved from the mandate of the state law and how the state law requires it to be done. But it also doesn't restrict a school district from reserving funds for other purposes. And so, for example, if a school district was in a position where they had a financial crunch or realizing they did not have revenues perhaps coming in at the rate that they would anticipate, it allows them to in effect, create a budget for themselves, and by doing that, not have those funds that they want to dedicate for other purposes become a part of the process of negotiation when settling contracts. Because the other part of the bill, provisions of the bill, deal with the ability of bargaining units to strike over funds that have been reserved in these reserve accounts. So I think that as a part of the conversation we've been having this year, to me this is an important provision that should be considered. I'd like to invite your contemplation of it, and perhaps if you're forming a policy omnibus bill, this might be included as part of that. But it simply gives a large amount of discretion to local school boards to determine how they are going to spend money and to give them a tool that will allow them to manage those funds so that they are not put in the position of settling for contracts that may be beyond their capacity to realistically afford, along with everything else that they feel they need to do. So that, it's not a very long bill. It's not lengthy. I think the concept is fairly straightforward. And there is a fiscal note attached, but there is no cost that has been identified in the process. It does not, I don't believe, have any state cost. It would certainly have potentially some effect on what school districts' budgets might look like, but it would be an effect that they would choose for themselves. So, Madam Chair, I do not have any testifiers. This is not a bill that was brought to me by any organization. I thought it might be worth revisiting in this session, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. And I don't know if there's people who wish to testify.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. Jody Boer with Education Minnesota. And I'll be brief, but I do need to go on the record and say that we have concerns about this bill. Senator Hand mentioned things such as local control, mandate relief, and we believe that this isn't local control and, frankly, that we should trust those that are managing the school district budgets to do so, and don't really see this as necessary. In addition, it would, in fact, or it could, if districts chose to create such a fund, I realize that the language is permissive, and it does say that they may create such a fund, but if they do, then it is must when it comes to the ability to collectively bargain. And so this could be a wage freeze. It could even result in lower wages. And then, of course, we have the strike provision or the prevention of that as well. And so we, again, would ask the question is, why is this necessary? We should trust local control, those that are managing the money to do so. And we believe that this is, again, potentially targets our hardworking and dedicated teachers. So those are my comments. Be happy to take questions if you have them. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the testimony. One of the reasons that I thought this might be worth hearing is as we've had discussion on Senator Thompson's provision that is in our omnibus bill. In fact, just last Friday I was out in my district talking with a group of teachers, and one of the concerns that has been brought about the statewide two-year hard freeze, if you will, of all costs, all salaries and benefits at the school district level is that there are people who say, well, this really flies in the face of local control. Why don't you trust local people to make the decisions, do the right thing? And, of course, our response is that we do trust local officials. However, they may need some tools that they don't currently have. And I would argue that this is the kind of tool that if they had this tool, then the two-year freeze that we have passed into the bill would probably not be necessary because it would empower local schools to make the decision to have a hard freeze if that's what they decided, simply by making sure that they reserved funds that would protect their ability to fund the other things in the district and in reality, I guess, not allow there to be additional funds subject to increasing the cost to the bargaining unit. So I guess I'm confused by the opposition. If the other bill is not local control and this isn't local control, then I'm not sure what is local control except the status quo. And I think that from my perspective, the status quo does not facilitate the ability of local decision makers to be effectively able to manage what they've been charged to manage.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess what I hear Senator Hand saying is that this would actually be a compromise to some of the bills going forward, some of the bills that are a frontal assault on collective bargaining. So I appreciate you bring that forward in that spirit. And my question is with regard to the reserve. So it doesn't seem to me it would make any sense to have the bills that are currently in the bill and this, because that does feel oppressive. But were those other things in the conference committee process not to survive, I think this is an alternative approach to give some flexibility to districts. How would this relate to our state's ability to take reserves? So now we're going to be putting more money into, if this went forward, imagine now you're going to put real, you know, pretty large amounts of money into a reserve account that now you're going to set the school districts up to be vulnerable to have them come and take and borrow.
And Madam Chair, and Senator Bonhoff, that's a good question. I have not had that question asked before on this particular topic, and I could use some probably assistance from counsel, but I believe that the ability for the state to use reserves would only apply to those reserves that the state has mandated, I believe. I'm not positive about that,
no.
But maybe not. I'm not sure. But it would be a good question worth asking. I think we did some things to try to, I guess, preserve the ability of the state to use those reserves, but not mandate that they be used, I think, is what we've...
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, yeah, they don't have to, but it seemed, given how aggressively they wanted to preserve that ability... I am concerned about it. I do suspect it'll be used. And we changed the threshold, so instead of it being $350 per pupil, it went to $700. But you could foresee, if something like this was in place, that you could pretty quickly build those kinds of reserves. So I think you'd actually have to create a separate account rather than a reserve so that you wouldn't put any funds at risk were this to go forward.
And
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, I think I understood the question. If, to the extent that your question was, does the 127A46 cash flow borrowing get in the way of Senator Hand's legislation, or vice versa? Does Senator Hand's legislation get in the way of that? And I think the answer is no. It's pretty clear that the 127A46 cash flow borrowing speaks directly to the school district's operating reserve and includes a calculation of that. These dollars would be set aside at the school district's discretion. I don't believe that law would cross-reference these funds if they were set aside.
And Senator Bonhoff, you mentioned about the other funds. I think there's only one of these three that has been identified as lifting the requirements for the set aside. The other two,
and Madam Chair?
Well, Madam Chair, it says a school district that reserves funds in the reserve for essential uses account. So what I was concerned about is, were they one and the same? the funds that sit in that operating reserve, is that one and the same as this account? It's not.
That's actually, it's their fund balance.
Yeah.
It's the fund balance. That is not a reserve account.
Okay.
That's part of the challenge that many districts have, is that it doesn't mean dollars in the bank. It's what their fund balance is that the state is borrowing from.
Madam Chair.
It's at a specific point in time in the fiscal year.
Madam Chair, I just went to the cash flow borrowing statute, and to the extent that that's the issue, the calculation that's made there speaks very clearly to the net cash balance of the district's operating funds on June 30th. And I think what's happening here is the district would be segregating those funds into a different place. Now, you could argue that creates an incentive or helps districts segregate funds away from away from the net cash balance, which would potentially reduce the amount of resources that the state would have available for the cash flow borrowing. And maybe that's a good thing or maybe it's not, but I think it's pretty clear that it would not apply here.
Thank you. Good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just guess I need a clarification. Senator Bonoff confused me, so maybe Senator Hahn may clarify this for me. She said this is kind of a bill that really addresses the issue of not getting into a collective bargaining agreement issue, and it's kind of an alternative route, and so that this is a preferable route, and so that we don't get into the other arguments. And to me, Subdivision A in Section 2, Subdivision 1, actually makes it very clear that this is about stopping school districts and really interfering with the rights of teachers to do collective bargaining. Because if not, this language will not be here. So I don't have a problem with establishing an account and giving the flexibility and the local control that you talk about, Senator Hahn. Actually, that's pretty good. This is not local control. You're saying you must. So could you clarify, because the establishing the account is in May, and so you say, you may do that. I'm pretty sure that this will be a must because they will establish the account, and you know that. And now then you're saying if you establish that account, you must. So that's not then local control is out. We're imposing a most on collective bargaining. So could you clarify that for us, please?
Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, the idea that it's not local control, I think, flies in the face of clearly this is an option. No one is required to do this. We elect local school board members, and we say, you're in charge of a school district. You make the decisions about how the money is spent and how it's going to be used, and you are in charge of that. And what we do at the state level is we put conditions on that. And we hear complaints periodically. We've heard complaints most recently about the two-year freeze as being something that we are doing, taking away the ability of local units of governance to make decisions about how to deal with their costs. But many of us have argued over the years that the ability of local school districts and school board members, of which I was one at one time, to actually make decisions at the local level is not there. There's no question that the largest costs that school districts have to deal with are their employee costs at all levels, salaries, benefits for not just teachers, but the whole body. That's 80% of any school district's budget. And to be able to suggest that those local elected officials can't, if they wish, decide to hold those costs flat from one year to the other, why shouldn't they be able to do that? And right now there is no mechanism in law that permits them to do that. There is none. There's no mechanism that says these local elected officials who decide that they don't have enough money to do everything else they want to do and meet the growth in the contracts, the continuing contracts, they cannot say, well, we are going to decide to freeze those costs. There's no possible way for them to do that. So what the premise of the bill is that you need to have tools at the local level if you are going to have a local control system. If we are not going to give local elected officials the ability to do things like this, then we will have to periodically intervene at the state level and do things because the local schools have no way to do the things that we can do through law. So all this is doing is creating the kind of structure that when we, for example, pose the 2% staff development set-aside dollars, those monies are not open to be bargained for. When you get to a contract, you cannot bargain for the 2% of the fund that is dedicated to staff development. That is not in the bargaining pool. And what this is saying is if a local district wants to create some reserve or special purpose funds for special for things that they want to do, then they would have the same status as the mandates that the state passes. That's all it's doing. And it is permissive. It does not require that any district do this, but if they do do it, it does say the structure of how that is to be done.
I have a follow-up, Madam Chair, if I may.
I just have a question to interject here. Is the state-mandated collective bargaining local control?
I don't know who. Are you asking?
If we've mandated collective bargaining, why? How do we use the argument of local control within that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that's precisely my question. I think that's exactly the question that I'm trying to ask. So the entire bill is, or your argument is built on the premise of local control, and it's clear. It's clear from, you know, what you just said is very clear to me, Senator Hand. It says, you know, the transfers may, you know, the district may. The school district funds reserved for essential account is not required. You use very language that really gives absolute local control throughout. Then you come to Section 2, and that's about collective bargaining. And then you use the word must. So you no longer use may. It is not required. And then you go back to the permissive language, which I think is so much about local control. So that's precisely my question, Senator Olson. You know, when we go back and forth in choosing the local control, you know, they may establish, they may use it for this, they may not. But when it comes to collective bargaining and the teacher's role in here, now that's a must. So either way, you know, whether we impose it as a, you know, obviously we have a differences of political opinion on it. I probably will use it the other way around, obviously. But you know, the inconsistency, I think, is exactly what I'm trying to point to, that you now are imposing only on the collective bargaining.
And Madam Chair? Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, there is nothing that requires a school district to devote any monies to these accounts. And so arguably the reason to do this is that if they wish to bargain for a contract that doesn't have any increase in dollars,
I get that.
Then they can set up a way to do that. And if you don't put the language that they must not enter into collective bargaining, then they get into collective bargaining and all those reserves become subject to bargaining. So they've not been able to accomplish their purpose. So you cannot have the purpose of having a local decision about how much money you're going to put on the table to bargain unless you have this language. That's the only way to do it. If you want to say local officials should be able to determine how much money they're going to put on the table to bargain, you have to have some mechanism like this. So either we're going to permit local decision-making about that or we're not. I would argue we should. And I think there's a number of ways you could do it. This is not the only way, but this is one way that I think makes some sense. And to Senator Bonhoeff's point, I think that this is probably, at least in my opinion, preferable to imposing a two-year freeze across the state at the legislative level. That if we had this in place, we would not have to take that step. We would say, look, if local school districts are concerned about managing their funds, they have a tool to manage their funds. That's really what this does.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Hand. Help me understand this. So this may just be my lack of knowledge, but what would prohibit, if you're looking at it from the teacher perspective, what would prohibit a school district from ever setting aside all of their money they get from the state into a specified account? So therefore, there would never be, even when the state isn't in a budget crunch situation, you're essentially, if I understand this correctly, you're giving the school board the authority to forever take off the ability to negotiate for increased salaries or benefits.
And Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, I guess you ask what would prevent that, and all I would say is good judgment and common sense of local elected school board members. Which local elected school board member would say, I never want to give our teachers any increase in pay? Who would do that? Does that even make sense to do that? Do we believe that school board members are so incapable of deciding that they need to have well-paid staff, that they're incapable of making decisions about what it takes to retain and train and keep well-paid? Of course, we're all interested, but they also have a fiduciary responsibility to manage the funds that are available to them, and they can't manufacture funds. And so all we're saying is that given that limit, they ought to have tools to manage within those limits. But you're right, there's nothing to say that the legislature couldn't decide to never put any more money into education. We could do that. That's within our power. We could decide never again to put any more money into education. We could do that. We're empowered to do that, but we don't. And we don't do that because it doesn't make any sense. And all I would say is local school board members also have the common sense and good judgment to say they will spend the money that they need to spend, but if they don't have the money, they've got to have some tool to use to manage that, and that's what this provides.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that this is an important lesson, and that we do need to, especially I think I need to say this, I consider myself still a freshman because I've been here for 4 years, and education is such a tough, you know, field that you really need to be here for a few years to understand it, in my view. But this is how we worked out members' formulas in a way that somehow we boxed them in a place in a given time. If we were to truly speak about the flexibility needs to be infused into everything we do. So a correct use of this power that we have today to influence this will be a may in every single place. But there is a trend right now to really impose and change certain things. Senator Stephen is absolutely correct. There is absolutely no way to control right now. And Senator Hand just say, well, you know, we will trust judgment and we will hope that they will not transfer all the funds. Well, guess what? We have done that for years, members. No, that's not responsible policy. You do not propose bills to say, well, you know, we're going to trust the districts that they will not transfer all of these funds and that they will use the accounts this way. Senator Stephen, we should not, I believe, members, we should not move policy. That's not good policy work to rely on trust and faith. That's not what we do here. So clearly, if we were to say today that we want to establish this account, that we want it for certain purposes, and that we want to give these districts local authority and power to decide, be it. So that means collective bargaining too, Senator. That means collective bargaining too. They are capable of doing that. Teachers are not evil here. Teachers are not about themselves. There is a message in here that for everything we want flexibility. But for you, teacher, to do your contract and to enter collective bargaining, no, that we don't trust. That we're not going to allow it. And I have a problem with that, Senator. I am sorry, but I just think we're going too far in terms of really dictating to districts as to why we think they need to do, what is local control and what is not local control. And when it comes to collective bargaining, I think we're going too far because these accounts will be established so that teachers will have no power. And I think that is very disempowering, very demoralizing, and that's what teachers are telling us right now. This is very demoralizing. I'm willing to work with you on these issues of, you know, maybe there is a time where teachers need to come to the table. Well, let's do a may. Why do you have to do a must?
And Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, first of all, let me just comment. I think that the same people who elect us elect local school board members. And to suggest that those people are not as competent as we are to make good decisions about education, I think, is wrong. And I think that when you talk about being disrespectful to teachers, there's nothing more disrespectful to a local school board member than to say that your judgment doesn't count as compared to a state legislator's voice. And that's not true. People who are elected at local school boards are there because the people have elected them to make decisions about their local schools. And all we're saying here is they need some more tools. And I accept your argument that you'd like the whole thing to be permissive, and I would just go back to Senator Olson's. Let's make membership in the bargaining unit permissive then. It is a law today that if you are going to teach in a public school other than a charter school in this state, you must be a member and pay dues. In fact, we even have laws that those dues are collected by state employees and sent to the account of the bargaining unit. So I would agree with you. If we want to go down the road of being permissive, I'm there. And I'll join you on a bill you author to get rid of Make Minnesota. In fact, I have a bill, the Right to Teach Act, that does that very thing. And I'd be happy to join with you in passing that bill. But if we're going to require membership in an organization and then require collective bargaining be done in a certain set of conditions that we have seen over the years have the effect of making it impossible for a local school district, if it wants to manage its money. We've seen it has been impossible to do that. We've had, in the, 8 years I've been here, I think 1 year perhaps, where we put additional money on the formula. And I don't believe there's been a single year where local school district costs have not risen every year. Now, how does that happen? There's no money coming from the state. There may be some money coming from local levies, but essentially the funding has been flat. But every year the costs go up. And then what happens? To balance the budget, we lay off staff, we cut programs, we cut back, and then, of course, the state is blamed for not paying enough money. But the real problem is we do not have tools at the local district level to use by locally elected officials to make decisions about how to manage those funds. And this is just one way to do that. There may be others, but I think it is a reasonable way. It does reinforce the idea that these locally elected officials have a charge, and their charge is to manage that process, and we ought to give them the tools to do it. Well, Madam Chair, I'm open to, if you are interested in having this be considered for part of your bill, I'd be happy to have it laid over. Or if you'd like to just move it along, I'd be happy to have it just be moved along.
We're not sure exactly what's going to be happening along that, but if you wanted to send it along, it doesn't rule out if there's a...
Then I would respectfully ask that it be passed with the recommendation to go to the floor. I move that we pass or recommend that Senate File 619 be passed and referred to the floor.
I would like a roll call. I would like to request a roll call, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't know if this was going to be laid over or moved along, so I wasn't going to mention this. But line 219 through 221, I'm going to ask you, Senator, if this language accomplishes what you're trying to get to or not, and if you want to tweak it. As I read this, one way I could interpret that is if I am negotiating a bunch of different issues and also negotiating funds that are in or scheduled to be transferred, I'm in compliance because I'm negotiating issues other than that. In addition to that, that language seems a little bit vague to me, and my question is, does that get fully to your intent? Is that a reasonable interpretation? Do you want to tighten that language, or are you happy with it the way it is?
And Madam Chair and Senator, you know, I certainly am open to what counsel may offer, but my reading of that language says that the ability of a bargaining unit to strike, they are permitted to strike as long as they're talking about things that are funds that are not reserved. If the school district reserves funds for transportation or class size reduction or whatever it wants to do, and it has another set pool of money available for bargaining, that there certainly can be discussions and the normal process as it pertains to those funds available. But I think all this says is you can't go to strike over monies that aren't on the table. And I'd be happy to have counsel advise me on that if that's a different understanding than the one I have.
I think it says that.
Madam Chair, one concern I have with the process in terms of just sending this to the floor is that we have passed this other bill that's in conference that has all these provisions that relate to collective bargaining that taken with this make this a very heavy-handed approach, whereas if the wage freeze and the tenure that as a package that I think that sends a signal that I don't want to send. If those things weren't to go forward and this was a tool, well, I'd be voting for that, even though my colleagues don't agree with me. But so...
Senator Bonner, I don't know if you've noticed in past years we've had a load on general orders
right.
That sit there and nobody ever does anything with.
but they kind of want it there in case they need it. If it doesn't go through some other way, I mean, it's kind of been a backup that has traditionally been used, and I have no problem with people using. We've done it for a number of the bills around here from both sides of the aisle. That it may pass as a part of a combined bill, but it may not. But they may want to consider that, and usually as we get near the end of session, some of those are peeled off and sent back to the author or to back to committee or whatever. But it wouldn't rule out the consideration. If sometimes we've done that also, have we brought up bills on the floor of the Senate to establish the Senate position. And the House has done it differently, and so it doesn't mean it's going to pass. You know, we've got complicated systems around here that are designed to make it difficult to pass legislation.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to go on record that were it to be a total package, I would at the end of the day vote no, just like I ended up feeling that way about the other omnibus bill. But as a standalone, I'm going to just vote on the bill.
So roll calls for now.
Madam Chair?
Aye.
Senator Bonoff?
Aye.
Senator Chamberlain?
Yes.
Senator Daley?
Yes.
Senator DeCryf?
Aye.
Senator Hahn?
Aye.
Senator Harrington?
No.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Nelson?
Aye.
Senator Nino?
Yes.
Senator Sieben?
No.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Senator Torres Ray?
No.
Senator Uyghur? Senator Wolf?
Yes.
There being 11 yes votes and 3 no votes, the motion does prevail. And so the bill is...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Founders of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Tom Vanderart, and into the virtual education, and has got some really interesting things to say, and I'm glad he's willing to come and spend some time with us. He will be joined by somebody in his new endeavor that he has stolen, the head of the second largest state virtual school, which is in North Carolina. And I heard him speak, and he's made a number of references to a book that I have been plugging. So if you have the book, Disrupting Class, and had a chance to read it, you may want to familiarize yourself a little bit. Mm-hmm. He may reference it, because there's some interesting dynamics of what's going on in virtual education that are kind of exciting, and I think it's going to be an interesting time for us. So just put that on your calendar and I haven't seen it yet. I really like it.
Committee is adjourned.